Well, thank you so much for having me speak tonight. And what a special thing to be at Austin Recovery virtually and with you alumni, you amazing survivors, and my sisters and brothers, and to also have some of my close girlfriends on, which really makes me so happy. My name is Lori, and I'm an alcoholic and an addict. And thanks. Hi. It's so weird not to hear it back, but that's okay. I know you're thinking it. So I've been taught to share on the basis of what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. So that's what I'm going to do. And I'm hopeful that I'm going to spend more time talking about my life in recovery than my life in active addiction, because I think that that life in active addiction is something that all of us relate with, and I'll touch on sort of the thematic parts that I think have resonated for all of us over the years. But what I've come to understand is the specifics are less important than what happened to my spirit and my soul in the midst of my active addiction. And that's the part that I think really has done a lot of healing over the years, and the part that I still work on every single day. So, but I also want to start by saying I know it's Father's Day, and I really appreciate that you all choose to come. And I'm sure that some of you are stealing away from Father's Day activities. Some of you are missing a father for some reason, and some of you may not have a relationship with a father. So whatever your experience of the day is, I would like to sort of honor my own dad by telling a little bit about him, and also honor my ex-husband who died of this disease, who's the father of my son, who's having sushi with his stepdad in the other room. So so I want to just call out Alan Kay, who was a member of Al-Anon for 44 years when he passed. And I'd like to call the name of John H., and say that he was my best friend for a lot of years. He was sober before I was when we were dating. And but for the grace of God, go I, it could have been me, not him, that passed from this disease. So I just put that out there as a foundation for asking God to make me an instrument to whatever I can say that hopefully will be useful to somebody in the room. Take what you like and leave the rest. So here's my personal experience. I was the kid of an alcoholic. My mother's alcoholism was pretty flagrant when I was between the ages of 8 and 10. Sometimes I wish I could tell her story, because she had some pretty hilarious stories. She would climb trees with bottles of booze and refuse to come down. She got arrested once for drunken bicycle riding, things like that. So she was a pretty hilarious person, but she was also pretty miserable when that disease got its claws, when the disease got its claws in her. And she sort of transformed from being this really loving, amazing, creative mom to this irritable, isolative, angry, yelling person. And my father and my brother agree that I was pretty much her scapegoat for her pain in her life. So I got yelled at for many, many, many hours. And there was no safe place in the house, so she would follow me wherever I went when she was yelling. So, so there was some difficult years there, but in she was in and out of psychiatric hospitals. But in August of 1975, my mother went to a psychiatric hospital. And there was finally a psychiatrist that just looked at my mom and immediately said, let's dry this woman up and see what she looks like. And nobody had ever even implied that the alcohol was the rapacious creditor, you know, that it was tearing her to shreds. Most doctors gave her a diagnosis of bipolar, or they gave her a diagnosis of schizophrenic, or they gave her a diagnosis of manic, or they gave her a diagnosis of depressed. And then they'd give her more pills, which she'd wash down with booze, and she got worse and worse and worse. So this doctor put her in the addictions unit, and she got sober. When they were in New Jersey, they used to do these things called commitments, where you would take a meeting to other parts of New Jersey and you'd caravan down and you'd, you know, bring, you know, moral support to the meeting. And then everybody on the way home would stop at a diner and then they'd spend hours and hours talking. So she wouldn't get home till like 2 or 3 in the morning, but she like loved AA. So I also have to say that one of the things I hope that I share when I'm telling my story is just how much I love AA. There's no other place where I feel as comfortable being 100% myself, regardless of how I'm feeling any given day. I really feel the unconditional love from people in the program. I think we have incredibly loving and sensitive people, because my take, and this might be grandiose, is that most addicts and alcoholics are the most sensitive and loving people in the whole wide planet. And that's part of the reason why we were so vulnerable to numbing ourselves. Just the world is a hard place to be when you're that sensitive, so to speak. And so so I just want to say, before I say anything else, how much I love this program and how I credit my entire family's recovery to this program. So my mom got sober and I started going to Alateen. So I started reading everything I could about alcoholism and addiction. And I read Go Ask Alice. And I read, you know, I would watch Father Martin do Chalk Talk lectures. And I was really into it. I was totally into it. And I loved that I felt grown up in my Alateen meeting, because I was only 10 and the rest of the kids were teenagers and all of that kind of stuff. Turned out, in hindsight, probably about 8 out of the 10 kids that I was in Alateen with turned out to be people with substance use disorders. We know from the science that that you're about twice as likely to be a person with a substance use disorder if you have parents that had a substance use disorder. One of my parents was, so I was the lucky one. My brother, who got caught with a six-pack of beer in his closet when in seventh grade, turned out not to have a problem with it. So we all thought it was going to be him. And I was actually a perfectionist as a kid. I was a super student and a brown noser with teachers and a teacher's pet and president of every club I'd become that I would be a member of. And I did a lot of community service. And it was all about proving to you that I was the best person on the planet. It didn't really come from a place of altruism or true kindness or empathy. I think at that time it was more, I wanted to look like a good person. But it was, I think, you know, not to discount that doing good things is a good thing, regardless of your motivation, but I was the kind of kid in high school that would sit by the keg and count how many beers everybody had had, and then start shaking my finger when somebody had had too much, and I'd take away their keys, and I'd tell them they had enough to drink, and I'd sometimes send somebody home to drive them home. So as you can imagine, I didn't get invited to a lot of keg parties. I was kind of a bummer at the keg parties. I started dating a guy my junior year of high school that was, I think, my first addictive relationship. I was totally head over heels for him. 6'2" blonde named Danny, who I followed around all over the place. And he asked me out and I was like in heaven. But that was my first experience of a partnership with somebody who had an active addiction. And he just kept booze in our locker at school and things like that. But I got introduced to drinking, by Danny. I was also introduced, Chris will like this. He hung with a group of kids that had a band, sort of a mediocre rock band in the 80s called Armageddon. And here I was, this goody-goody by day, and I was singing Judas Priest songs and Pat Benatar and stuff like that by night. So I was the lead singer and the keyboardist, and I really loved that scene. And I do think that even prior to picking up alcohol and drugs, there was something about the drug and alcohol scene that I just got high off of. I just loved sort of the riskiness of it and the raciness and the trying to be cool and the sex being woven into everything. And I mean, there was just a lot about it that I found really intriguing. And I also found it sort of a high to, I don't know, be living a double life, so to speak. So I like really prided myself in being able to be a chameleon, that, you know, I was on the field hockey team and I was a jock and I was in the theater crew and I was a drama geek and I was hanging out with the smart kids and the, you know, honor societies. And then I was this rock band singer. And then I was Danny's girlfriend. And I really loved being able to sort of shift and change depending on wherever I needed something. Essentially, it was mostly manipulative to get what I needed. And I think that's how I operated in the world for a while. But I do remember my very first experience of a beer was at a band practice, and it was cold in the broken down barn, and somebody handed me a Moosehead beer, and I drank it down, and I was in love with it immediately. That warm, burning sensation going down, and you all know that sensation of suddenly feeling like my insecurities were lifting and that I was funny enough and pretty enough and that I sounded better on the mic and that, you know, like all of that stuff was happening for me. And the more I drank, the more it seemed to happen. So that was my first drinking experience. And about a week later, we were going to the movies and Danny brought a bottle of Bacardi 151 in the car and some big thing of Sprite. And or 7-Up or whatever it was, and Dixie cups, and we were taking shots of, you know, half Bacardi and half Sprite, and I turned to Danny and I said to him, "Why would anyone?" And he said, "Drink this stuff." And I said, "No, why would anyone mix it with anything? Just quit it with the Sprite already." Like, I wanted it straight up. I wanted as much as I could have, as fast as I could have. I just loved the sensation. And so I've come to understand, you know, you guys know that I'm, I actually am an addictions researcher and have done a lot of the work of getting educated on the brain science and neurochemistry of this stuff. And I was, it was so clear that I had a different brain chemistry than somebody that can drink socially. Like, so clear from the first time I added alcohol to my system. It was, I think Carlton Erickson used to call it a disrupted pleasure pathway. Like, my desire for something to make me feel better is hardwired in my brain. And that's what gets rid of all the stigma for me. Like, I am not ashamed to say that I'm a person in long-term recovery. I identify that way in public on a regular basis, because I think people need to know that we get well from this disease and that it really is a bona fide illness with treatment and recovery that works. And so I'm grateful to say that that's true. I didn't get into recovery right away. I went off to college and had what I consider sort of four gray years that sort of blend together. I wanted to die on a regular basis. I was driving myself to military bases to meet guys, then get free booze. I was taking people's medicines from their medicine cabinets and washing it down with booze. I hated myself. I was also a compulsive overeater, and I was gaining weight like nobody's business. I was also really hungry for relationships and just moving around from relationship to relationship. I was sort of the definition of self-will run riot, as our big book says. I was totally out of control in every single way. And my only cover up, because my mom had become an addictions counselor by then, my only cover up was that I was determined to get good grades. So I picked college courses on the basis of which ones I could schmooze with the teacher and convince them to give me an A, or I felt I could do while I was drunk or high. So I wound up studying something called avant-garde literature, which is like, they also call it theater of the absurd. It's really out there kind of stuff that most people can't make sense of, even if they are high. And so that's what I did. Now, I tell y'all that I have to say that my understanding of my higher power is that he needed me to have my college education to be able to follow the path that I followed afterwards. So I consider that a blessing and a grace of God, nothing I did in and of myself, but that was a gift in my life so that I could be doing the stuff that I'm doing now. But I was totally out of control and wanted to die. And I came home from college and I was working in a nursing home. I actually was throwing happy hours at the nursing home so that I could drink at work. So I made sure that there was beer and wine there every 5 o'clock it would roll around. When I actually was in program long enough to decide it was time to make amends, I did my fourth and fifth step and realized how dangerous that was for these elderly folks that were in the nursing home. I went back and the nursing home had gone out of business. And I pray to God it wasn't because of my irresponsible behavior, but I tell you that because my thinking was so warped around drugs and alcohol that I really believed that anyone that had a situation that was miserable, that alcohol was the solution, even though I just was so delusional because it was not the glue that was holding my life together. It was the solvent that was making it come apart. But I just couldn't imagine my life without it. And I couldn't imagine somebody else being comfortable or having a life worth living without it. And by the time my addiction really got to the worst place, I no longer believed in things like love or honesty or friendship, justice, goodness, because everything that I was doing was basically to manipulate to get my needs met. So I assumed that that's how other people were operating too, that it was all just bullshit, all just concepts developed by human beings to try to make life seem prettier and more bearable. Like I literally genuinely did not believe in those things. And anybody that knows me knows that that's been turned inside out in my world because of this program. Like I not only believe in those things, but I live in those spaces. I pray every morning for the capacity to be useful in the world. I navigate my relationships on the basis of being as loving as I possibly can, as honest as I possibly can, as giving as I possibly can. I believe that my friendships and my family are the greatest gifts from God. And that at the time that I was using, none of those things made sense to me. It all seemed so painful and so confusing, and relationships felt so stressful. That being said, you know, I was I'm sort of off the deep end on being an extrovert. So I was just feeling uncomfortable all the time in my active addiction. And towards the end, I was going to ACOA meetings because there was an ACOA meeting, Adult Children of Alcoholics, right next to my mom's AA meeting. And I just loved seeing the people in the program. Like they were the people with the glimmer in their eye, with the hope. There were, I remember sitting in the ACOA meeting and be able to hear the laughter through the wall from the AA meeting and feeling like, God, if only I qualified for that program, which is so freaking crazy when you think about it. Like, I'm going to tell you that I got into the program because my ex-husband, who I was dating that summer between college and getting sober, he was 4 years sober. And believe it or not, he was like a bird watcher or something like that, which seemed like the antithesis of fun for me. Like I liked loud, you know, I don't know, discos with flashing lights and loud music. And he liked bird watching. So I was like, what the hell am I getting myself into? But we used to go to Harringtown Woods in Princeton and just wander around out there. And that's where I fell to the ground and said, I'm living a lie. I'm not who you think I am. I'm miserable. Every time we go on a date, I wait till you drive away and I go to Good Time Charlie's and get drunk and I use all these substances and I mostly want to die and I'm a lie. And that's when he said to me, he said, it doesn't sound all that complicated to me. It sounds like you're an alcoholic and you need a meeting. And so I went to my first, I actually went to an NA meeting before I went to AA because I wasn't sure I was really willing to give up alcohol. But I went on August 23rd of 1987. And by the grace of God, have not had to have a drink or a drug ever since. And that is a direct gift of this program and a little bit of luck and also a lot of God's protection, because in some ways I believe that even my character defects in the beginning in some ways were protective. So like my very first home group in Princeton, New Jersey was called the 24-Hour Club, and they had these mugs, these coffee mugs where they put your name, like it said Lori K, and your sobriety date, right? So, and they hung them on these pegs on the wall. And so everybody would come in and they would get their mug and they'd drink coffee. And I literally, on the verge of relapse, would think, oh, screw it, I'm not gonna do it today because I don't wanna have to tell them I need a new mug. Like, that's insanity right there. Like, that was all my pride. That was all pride. But in a way, that pride kept me sober. So I'm here to tell you that any freaking reason for you to postpone the next drink if you're feeling like a drink is a good reason. Any reason. Like, there's no wrong reasons. Like, they used to say, you have to get sober for yourself. You can't do it for somebody else. I think that's BS. I think in the beginning, nobody loves themselves enough to get sober for themselves. None of us do. It's part of the definition of what brings us to that point of desperation. We freaking hate ourselves in the beginning. So if you're doing it for somebody else, like, who the hell cares? Just do it, right? Do it because you're doing it because of somebody who passed away's spirit's looking over you. Do it because you're better to your pet. Do it because alcohol is expensive. Who the hell cares why you do it? Because I'm going to tell you this. You stick around and you put days together, which become weeks, which become months, which become years, which become a lifetime. And I'm going to tell you right now that my life is so beyond my wildest dreams that I still have moments where I get depressed or I get irritable or I get funky or I look at myself in the mirror and think, oh, I'm ugly or whatever the hell I'm going through. But I know that those are warped voices of my disease and that it's not true. And that happens. I can't even tell you when that happened. You know what I mean? You just keep coming and you stick around. And at some point you're like, oh my God, like I can see my value in the world. Like I can see that I'm a lovable person. I ain't perfect. Nobody is. You know, I've got glaring character defects. I'm sure my husband would be willing to give you his inventory of my defects. Defects are funny things. I was once told that when you feel like you're tripping over that same stone, like here I go again, another freaking same time I'm going to be struck by fear, or I'm going to be struck by insecurity, or I'm going to be struck by self-hatred. It feels like the same stone that you're tripping over. Here's the coolest part, is if you're working the 12 steps of this program, what looks like the same stone isn't the same stone, because the way we grow is sort of like spirals, right? So it's on a higher spiritual level every time you trip on that stone. It's a different stone, because if you really were to take a look at it, if there were a movie of your life, like my experience is, if there was a movie of my life, that character defect, that I recognize it more quickly, that I don't hurt other people because of it as much, I get out of it more quickly, I reach out to help more quickly, and before you know it, I'm even spotting it when it's in like its early phases of effing up my day. Like, Like, I don't even have to wait the whole day to have a good day. I can start it over in the middle and say, holy crap. Like, oh, there I was, you know, in the quicksand of my self-pity. And I think I've had enough of that, you know? So it's really kind of amazing the way that this program works. And I mentioned Father Martin in the beginning, and for some reason he's on my mind a lot, but he was this priest. I'm actually a Jewish person in recovery, but I don't care about religious stuff. I feel like God is brilliant enough to have many, 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 many representatives in lots of different religions to bring us to him. So they're all good stories, whichever one you hook into. That's what the big book says, you know, use whatever works for you. But Father Martin used to say that one of our downfalls as alcoholics, and I think this is really true in my story, and my girlfriends will attest to this, is I lead with emotions. I am a very emotional person. You can feel it when I talk. I'm a passionate person. I overflow with emotion sometimes. It can be to the point where it's a character defect. I'll tell you what my husband's favorite part of my story, since it's Father's Day, I'll throw it in there, that when I was in early recovery, I went to this meeting, and I'll come back to Father Martin's message in a second, but I want to tell you this quick story. So I had moved to Philadelphia, because I was going to school there, and I was a member of the 4021 club, because I like to be, because I was terminally unique, I like to stick out like a sore thumb. That was a black AA club. I was one of the only white people who was a member. I felt totally comfortable there, but truthfully, now understanding that, my sponsor, who was an incredible woman, got me a speaking engagement when I was 90 days sober. I realized how terrifying my story was in terms of drugs and alcohol. And then she said, fly, be free, go hit some white meetings. She was hilarious. But I felt really, really, I have to say, that I'm an emotive person, and, the hallelujahs and you tell it, girl. And, the emoting during a meeting, like I miss that. I love that. I probably would have loved evangelical churches. I get very pumped up by emotion. And so I was emoting in early recovery. I had about a year of recovery, and I was in a really large meeting in Philadelphia at the Salvation Army. It was just a huge meeting. A lot of people would come drunk because they had Dunkin' Donuts there. So it was a really sort of wide spectrum of people. And I was crying and sharing all about my emotions and how this program was, you know, allowing me to be so real. And a little old man stood up and pointed at me and started to yell, I would rather have cirrhosis of the liver than listen to this woman share another word. And he stormed out of the meeting. And I always joke that was God's way of shutting me up in my early recovery, because probably nothing short of that would have shut me up. But I really was kind of like this annoying woman that would go on and cry in meetings every time I shared. And so what Father Martin used to say is he used to say that we need to learn that our emotions don't run us, that we get choices. So what he used to say is put I over E, and that's intellect above emotion. So it's a lot like cognitive behavioral therapy, if ever you've been in those types of therapeutic groups. But we have the power to sort of think through stuff and decide, is this emotion serving me? And I still sometimes lose track of that. I have to say, I just had a conversation with my sponsor last week and shared in my women's meeting that I was in a management team meeting at UT, and I got very emotional about sort of responding to the stuff that's going on in terms of race and justice these days. And my tears and my emoting made the meeting very uncomfortable for people who aren't comfortable with that level of emotional sharing. Now, in an AA meeting, you guys are used to that. If I were to burst into tears, which I may before I finish, because I get very grateful when I tell my story, you would say, oh, yeah, that's Lori doing her thing. Like, we love you. But in my work meeting, it wasn't so comfortable. So I have to, so sometimes it still gets away from me, but I just wanted to share it as a tool that my sponsor talked to me about containment and about how I can use different ways of containing my emotions and deciding where I pour them out and where I don't. And so, but I think that's an example of a character defect that I've come really so far with. So from being annoying in AA meetings, so much so that somebody stood up and stormed out of the meeting because I was annoying, to being a person that I hope you're enjoying my story, but I get feedback so I know it's accurate, that I'm not difficult to listen to anymore. None of you have stormed out so far. And that I see my value and without having to sort of emote my way through it, but also that I can make amends to the people that I made uncomfortable in that meeting. I can decide to do it differently next time. But you can see how that particular stone that feels like the same one I'm tripping over, now that it's, you know, almost 33 years later, it looks different. In fact, my sponsor even said to me, maybe your tears shook loose the truth in that meeting in a way that nothing else could have. Maybe that's what God wanted from you in that meeting. In fact, she helped me realize that I was asked, how's everybody feeling about this? And I answered honestly. So while I think that we, you know, I still prefer the term recovering alcoholic to recovered, because I never, ever want to forget that my brain chemistry, that my brain retains the memory of a high in solution to stress, and that will never go away. So when I am under stress, this COVID stuff has been weird for all of us, and where our nation is politically, where our nation is economically, where our nation is emotionally, where our nation is in terms of justice, all of these things are powerful stressors. I hope that you found ways to cope in ways that that work for you. But I'm going to tell you that in the meetings that I go to, even people with long-term sobriety have said, I've had more drunk dreams, I've thought of using more often. And that's our brain chemistry, folks. That's part of the deal. Like, we never, ever want to forget that we have disrupted pleasure pathways, and that stress is something that triggers that memory of a high in our brains. So that means for me that I need to be working my program better than ever. I have to be making myself vulnerable with my home group, with my women, with my sponsor, that I have to be making amends really quickly. So I have to go back to sort of nightlies, you know, doing my 10 steps and stuff, so I'm not accumulating unmanageable fourth and fifth steps. I have to be reading more, so I put my meditation books in the bathroom. But I got to tell you that here's the gift part. You know, I guess we read the promises at the end. I am living a life, like I said, so far beyond my wildest dreams that I can't even believe it. It is not perfect. There are a lot of things that if I were writing a script would come out different. But most of the time, the life that God's given me is so much better than I as a human being could ever have imagined. And that part of the promises about we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it, the parts of my past that were the deepest wounds have managed to heal over these years and allow me to be empathic with people that are put in my life that I might serve and help in ways that I never dreamed possible. So the parts of my story that I have the most shame about have been gifts in terms of making me useful. There it is. To other people in the program. Useful in a way that is unique and magnificent. magnificent. I think that we ought to be proud to be addicts and alcoholics, because I do believe that we have an opportunity to overcome a disease that kills more than a third of the people who have it. We have unique perspective in the world that allows us to have a blueprint for living well, even in these bizarre, chaotic times. Like, other people are spinning out, man. They don't have a way to work through the program. I'm going to share one more tool that's been working for me the past couple of days. So, yesterday, 2 days ago, was the 2-year anniversary of my dad's death. And my dad was my favorite person on the whole planet, I don't mind saying. And so I've been going through some grief and loss. And I still believe that we get to have the capacity to see the beauty in our most painful moments. And part of the reason that I experienced such deep grief about my dad is that we had a beautiful relationship, partially, if not wholly, because of this program. And also, I know that part of the reason the grief is so deep is because he was such a fabulous and amazing person that his departure from this planet left such a huge hole in my life that of course I'm sad and of course I miss him, and that it's sort of a blessing to be able to feel that today without numbing it, and that it's okay, and that I know that I still have a spiritual relationship with my father. I choose to believe that when I talk out loud, I can conjure up his word and my mom's presence in my life. I still ask my mom to pick my earrings when I'm getting dressed. That sounds stupid and ridiculous to some people, but I love engaging her in my everyday life. But I have to say that being able to work the program on something I'm powerless over is amazing, because I'm going to tell you folks, the number of things we're powerless over, especially in this time of COVID and especially in this time of racist upheaval, we are super powerless right now. But what do we have power over? We have the power to take care of our own safety. We have the power to take care of the ones that we love. We have the power to connect with each other and be there for other addicts and alcoholics and be useful in the world in that way. And we have the power to work our program to maybe up the ante a little bit, read something, even if you don't feel like it. You know, my first sponsor from that 4021 club used to say, throw your keys under your bed so that you have to get down on your knees in the morning and pick them up so that it reminds you to pray to God. You know, I like that. Another member of my home group used to say that when my heart was pounding in my chest, that was God knocking to get my attention. Like, all the little things that come from meetings like this that we can use that make us, I don't know, that elevate us to that higher level of spirituality on the spiral, you know, never getting it perfect, but tripping over what feels like the same stone, but that it's actually a different stone. But I'm teaching you that one of my sponsors over the years used to tell me that we could work these 12 steps on any issue that we are struggling with. So I'm going to teach you two more tools, and then I'm going to turn it back over for our wrapping up and any celebrations that we might have. So the first tool is working all 12 steps on one issue. So let's say that I am feeling a resentment that somebody didn't get back to me or something when I texted them or something like that. So I can run through all 12 steps and make myself useful in the world again. So I can actually say I'm powerless over that person's lack of response to my text, and my life's becoming manageable, if it's true. Sometimes it's that simple. I get unmanageable and totally obsessed with something as stupid as a text message. Then I invite God in, because I have come to believe that a power greater than myself is the solution, and I turn my will and my life and that text message correspondence over to the care of God as I understand it, I may have to write about it if I've got all kinds of warped stories going on about it. I may have to tell my sponsor about it if I'm not yet able to let it go. I recognize that my character defects are interwoven into that situation, and I have to ask where I have a role in that, and I have to ask God to remove those character defects. Usually it's grandiosity and fear. Those are my two biggies. So when it's a text message, it's, I'm so important, how could that person not take time to get back to me? Or fearful, that person, I've done something to hurt that person and they're leaving my life. Both really warped stories. But once I'm through to the seventh step, maybe there is something that I did to do that hurt that person. If I reviewed over it and came up with something, then maybe I have to do that ninth step and make that amend. And then that evening, maybe I do a mini inventory on my fears and my and what went wrong and what went right that day. And then I pray and I meditate and I give it to God. And then I get the hell out of myself. Because the truth is, if I'm spending all this time doing 11 steps on text messaging, I better the hell call somebody up and say, how are you doing today? And get out of my own head. So there's an encapsulated use of the 12 steps. Like, I think we can use them as a tool on anything. Like, they're miraculous because you know what? This stuff gets lifted. You don't want to go to all that trouble. I think that one of the biggest tools that works in my life is my God box. So when I was taught, because I'm a person that tends to have anxiety, you know, I get eczema and all kinds of nervous energy, and I'm not that soothing to listen to. So I apologize if I'm making you a little nervous, maybe too much caffeine before the meeting. But one of the things that works is when I have one of those obsessions going on in my head, I write it down with the date and the time. And I say, dear God, can't stop worrying about my son who drives Uber, or dear God, can't stop worrying about whether or not I'm going to get this promotion, or dear God, can't stop worrying about whether or not I pissed off so-and-so and that's why she's not returning my text. I write it down. I put it in a box marked God. I actually, when they did this at the Adolescent Recovery Center where I worked, they used coffee cans and they wrote on it God can. Isn't that cute? Like, instead of God box, it was a God can. I think that's very cute. But so I put it in there, and what I was taught is that every time that thought actually returns to my head and I take it out, figuratively, of course, from my God box, I have to write it down again and put it back in there. So it does two things. One, it's a literal act of the third step of giving it to God, right? I admit I can't do anything about this. It's driving me batty. I'm going to give it to God. And I do that over and over again until a solution emerges or it's lifted from me. I'm going to tell you something. I've had that God box since 1989, and I can pick any little piece of paper out of it. I had to, actually, my friend had a God box party where we decorated bigger God boxes because mine was packed so damn full that I needed to make it a shoebox size. But I keep everything in there. And here's the other cool part. If you are an agnostic and you're not sure there's a God in your life, and you're just going through the motions and using somebody else's higher power, which again is just fine, check it out after a couple of years of keeping one of these God boxes, because I can pull any piece of paper out of that box, any one, and see that God resolved it better than I could have imagined it resolved. I am not kidding you. There are thousands of pieces of paper in that box of things that I thought were fucked up in my life that no one could fix. And they were either given back to me as gifts so that I could be useful in the world, or they were resolved. They were lifted, like the promises say. So that's what I got for you tonight. Do not quit before the miracle happens. I am so grateful to have been able to share this stuff with you because it keeps me accountable, creates some dissonance for the things that I haven't been doing as regularly, so I get back to them. And hopefully something that I've said has been useful to you. I love all of you from the bottom of my heart. This program has saved me. It saved my life. It saved my family. And I just am so grateful that you were here tonight so that we could share this way. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Lori.
Thanks, Lori.
Thank you, Lori.
Great hearing you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you.
Hi, Lori. Thank you.
It was awesome to hear.